come to order. As a matter of we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3264 very briefly so that we can hear from a member of the Senate who needs to get on to another committee. Then we're going to close that public hearing and open a hearing and hopefully work session on 3532. We open the public hearing on 3264. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the courtesies. I'm needed in my own committee of judiciary right now. I simply wanted to greet you and let you know that I've brought a very important person to your committee today. We had testimony this morning on Senate Bill 518, which is a similar bill to House Bill 3264. As a result of that hearing, I do believe that we will probably get a work group together and try to merge these two bills. We had some very good testimony from the governor's office that is supportive of the concept, and we had excellent testimony from former Senator John Hottinger from Minnesota, who will give you some very, very compelling testimony about how this has worked in Minnesota, as well as you'll hear from Chuck Sheketoff from the Center for Public Policy, who is the reason I drafted the bill, because he wrote a great article called Biotech Beer and the Public's Right to Know. And so I asked for the bill to be drafted last July. It took 7 months to get it. And when I did, I found out Representative Rosenbaum, the two of us think alike in many ways. She used to be my sidekick in the House, and I appreciated it. So this is a fabulous concept. I'll let the others talk to you about it in the committee later today and appreciate your indulgence and your guidance.
Well, thank you, Senator Walker. We appreciate both the bill, your prescience on the issue, and we will look forward to hearing from our visitor.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would note that Senator Starr from the committee this morning has already signed up to be a member of the work group because he just really thinks this bill would be great. He comes at it from a different angle, thinking this bill will show that tax breaks are a good thing, and this is what they do show. I come at it from, well, not all tax breaks are good, but the ones that work and that don't work, I want accountability for so that we can make wise decisions. So I just think that's why we're all in agreement that this is a good thing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it, and we'll let you get on to judiciary.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we're temporarily going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3264 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3532. Mary. Oh.
Give an overview?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3532 will permit counties to reduce its certified expenditures and continue to receive funds from the County Assessment and Taxation Fund based upon its prior year's percentage if the following conditions are satisfied. First, the revenue in the prior year was supplemented by certain federal requirements, the PL 106-393, before know about it, in an amount equal to at least 10% of the expenditures certified by the department. The reduction in county expenditures does not exceed 10% of the prior year's certified expenditures, and the reduction in the county's expenditures does not result in a failure by the county to administer property taxes. Effective July 1, 2006, there is an amendment to the bill that would prevent the county's share due to reasons cited that I just cited and limit it to the fiscal year beginning July 1, 2006 and ending July 30, 2007. The reason that this bill is so important is that under current law, the funds available in the County Assessment Fund are distributed to counties, but in order to make the distribution, the Department of, and these funds come from recording fees, I believe, the Department of Revenue determines whether each county has submitted estimates of expenditures for the ensuing year that will adequately provide sufficient resources to administer property taxes. By July 15th, the department must issue an annual certification of approval or denial to each county with respect to its eligibility to receive a proportional share. If any county gets a denial, and many might in the event that they lose their federal forest revenues, the shares that are in the CAFA fund will be distributed to the remainder of the counties. Well, there is no revenue impact, but there is a distributional impact.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. The committee will recall that this is the bill that we asked the speaker to allow us to introduce in order to deal with the CAFA issue that we talked about early on. And I guess the first two witnesses we need are already here, so please, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Karen Gregory. I'm the property tax administrator at the Department of Revenue. And I would just like to thank the committee for hearing our testimony in February and getting this bill moved through the process very quickly. It will provide some flexibilities to counties who have determined that they will leave positions open, and one county at least has already laid off folks. So what this bill will do, should you approve it with the amendments, will allow the department to distribute the CAFA funds to these counties and not add to their financial burden. So again, thank you very much for moving this forward.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue also. And just to add to what Karen suggested, we tried to work with Legislative Revenue Office in getting some sort of benchmarks in the bill, and particularly with the comments that Representative Berger made during the February meeting, and that was the ones we chose were just trying to link it to counties that had funding from the Secure Rural Schools Act at some level, significant level. We just put 10% in, and that they reduced expenditures by X amount. We were going to leave it blank, but because of the urgency of the bill, we thought we'd put in an amount, so we chose 10%. We thought that still the concern of the committee was that the counties in their desperate situation at least not gut the assessment and taxation program, so we put that they might maintain the program standards at some adequate level, which is a little bit squishy. It's hard to determine, but we do annual reviews of their grants to make sure they're maintaining an adequate level in order to get 100% of the value on the roll and make the collections. And so that's in the bill also. And we did ask for the amendment because of the need for this to occur quickly, because the April 15th distribution is coming, and we will either distribute or not distribute, depending on what happens in the county. So thank you very much, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You may have said this, and I've been busy discussing other matters up here as we're talking. We are moving this bill with some expedition because of the understanding of your needs to process these issues. What is the time that you have to have a decision by in order to act on it for this coming year?
Mr. Chairman, the time frame is April 15th. It's at that point that we'll determine whether we will actually distribute to all 36 counties or whether we'll hold back some funds from some counties.
That's what I thought. So it's not only tax day, but it's also distribution of CAFA day. All right. Other questions for this panel? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one quick question. These are from recording fees, I understand. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, they're from recording fees as well as some delinquent taxes.
Okay, so a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Yeah. So a portion of this is that extra 4% on top of the 12% of the tax interest. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Butler, yes.
Okay.
There's a percentage that starts out at 25%. It's not exactly 25%, but it's a percentage of the delinquent interest is set aside for the what's called the CAFA fund or county assessment function funding account.
Final question, Mr. Chair. The combination of those two make up the amount that goes back to the counties. Is there any way of determining if there's roughly equity in that process as to who collects it? Because they send you the check for it on a monthly basis, I'm assuming, and then you're distributing it back to the various departments, 36 counties.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, the counties do send the money in quarterly, and the distribution is based on the amount that each county contributes to the entire assessment and taxation budget, if you will, for the entire state.
And Mr. Chair, I would like for the department to give us an analysis. You know what every one of the 36 counties are paying in those four quarterly payments, and you know how much you pay back to the 36 counties, I would like to have an accounting available in my file and for all the members of the committee of the amounts that are received by the department from the various counties and the amounts that are being distributed back. To know, I got a sneaking suspicion that there's not a great deal of equity, that the smaller counties are receiving some back because they just don't have the account numbers to work on that the larger counties do. But I think that that's kind of important for us to know that there is a redistribution of wealth in this process. Thank you.
We'll be happy to provide that, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Gail?
Chair, you might want to have John close by.
Yes.
Don't go away.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Policy Manager, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm wondering if you'd like to hear some good news first.
Please.
The Senate has approved the Wyden Amendment to the emergency appropriation measure about an hour ago, which would reauthorize in a different form the Secure Rural Schools Act. It is a five-year provision, starts off this year at the same level as last year, but then it reduces Oregon, California, and Washington by 10% for the succeeding 3 years. So we're at about 72-73% 4 years out. And then the fifth year, we drop into a new formula, which would basically gut the Oregon's take to about 40% of what it's was getting. So this is, and then after that, it expires. So this is timely. And it's timely, particularly for the long-term provisions that you'll be talking about and voting on as the session goes. Now the bad part of this, the bad news is it's on the back of a provision that needs to be reconciled with the House, needs to pass both chambers, and go to a president who has said that if either of those provisions are stated as they are now, he will veto them. So we could well come to a constitutional crisis.
Is this the Iraq War
yes.
issue? Thank you.
We could come to a constitutional crisis in mid-April. So, but it's one hurdle in a steeplechase. And we're told by experienced hands that you get it in, if it's vetoed and they've got to redraft it, it will likely stay in. The Wyden Amendment will stay in. So anyway. And Mr. Chair, to the bill, first of all, I want to thank Department of Revenue for offering the bill and for you for hearing it. It, however, is not in the form that we would want, and I want to explain why, and maybe we can work something through. First of all, on line 14 of page 2, the insertion of 10%, this was blank in the draft that we saw. And what we offered, what we suggested to you a couple weeks ago was that when we said we supported this concept is we would like this percentage to be equal to the percentage in the line above. In other words, if a county loses, is dependent upon, for its general fund, dependent upon federal forest revenues to the tune of 25%, say, that they would have, if that money disappears, they would have the ability to reduce for this year only, their expenditures, their certified expenditures to A&T by up to 25%. So that this would give counties the ability to do across-the-board cuts if they chose to. Not all will. Some will choose to protect this function. Others will have such demands on their public safety that they simply have to act to a greater extent than 10%. That also then raises the issue on line 17 about staying in compliance. And to continue to have to stay in compliance in that particular year of crisis without the ability that you see under the general provisions of entering into an agreement where a county falls out of compliance and then works with the Department of Revenue to enter into an agreement for over time to get back into compliance, without that kind of sort of safety valve, then this could negate the advantages and the flexibility in lines 14 and 13. So those are the two points that we agree that having it applied to a single year makes a lot of sense.
Excuse me a moment. Have you seen the Dash 1 amendments?
I have not, but as described to me, they only relate to the effective date.
Well, effectively, the Dash 1 amendments replace the bill, as I understand it. The because this is only designed to apply for 1 year, it was felt we didn't need to amend the Oregon Revised Statutes, so it's a separate freestanding statute just for 1 year. And now, I'm not sure that that makes any difference in your comment, but it might, and that's why I wanted you to
know that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, the provisions that I'm concerned about are still in the Dash 1 amendments.
Yes.
They're in the Dash 1 amendments. They're at lines 14 and 18. So, just to summarize, my suggestion is that the percentage that if a county has at least 10% dependent upon these federal revenues and they lose federal revenues, then their ability, the flexibility is that they could reduce their ANTI program to the amount equal to their loss generally in the general fund. So they can go across the board if they choose to do that in terms of their departments, in terms of reductions. And because of that, because it would be steeper than, say, 10%, mm-hmm. that raises the issue of whether there can be that provision plus the requirement that they stay in compliance, because I think that's it's a theoretical hope. I don't know that it can go from year to year continually in compliance if a county loses 25-40% of their general funds.
Okay, questions? Because I have a series of them that are related to your testimony. Representative Burger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't know if this is a question, comment, or combination thereof, but the way the amendment is written, it would only apply for the next fiscal year. And so if this problem goes into the next year, we will presumably either have to revisit this or something. Or it will go away. And also, to the testimony we just heard, it was not my understanding at the beginning of this that we were going to be totally giving relief commensurate with the problem. In other words, the percentage thing that Mr. Rydell is talking about was never in my mind. It was more a matter of trying to find a way to maintain these services as mandated as closely as we can and still give some relief from the Department of Revenue's mandates. I don't know that we're ready to work this bill, but I'm not ready to go there, I don't think, with the percentage-to-percentage business, because those percentages could get very high, and we still need assurance that the Department of Revenue is going to have something in the county that's going to collect, some system that's still intact. That's the purpose.
Thank you for the comment. I appreciate it, and it makes sense. Have you two had any conversations about this issue that we're talking about right now?
Very briefly before the hearing. That's why I asked if he.
Okay. We're moving this bill on a fast track because of the needs of the department and the counties to make a decision about the distribution. There's a couple of possibilities that occur to me. One of them is that we hold the bill over until Monday, that in the meantime, you two see if you can reach an agreement, and if we can get an amendment drafted that conforms to that agreement. A second alternative that occurs to me is that we adopt the amendment as it exists with your objections, send the bill to the floor for passage to the Senate, with the carrier of the bill making it clear that the bill goes only part way to what the counties want, and they'll give you an opportunity to discuss it with Senator Deckard and his committee. I'm frankly at a loss. Which you're taking risks, whatever we do, given the time.
I understand, Mr. Chair. In fact, if a county cannot limit their expenditure reduction to 10%, then it's quite likely the Department of Revenue will have to step in, so everybody will lose. We understand that.
Well, this is part of your conversation with Mr. Phillips, I think, and you're getting ahead of us a little bit. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, we're still receiving under 106.393 right now through the end of this through the end of June.
Right.
So that's June 2007, and this takes place for the fiscal year 2006-2007. Why would counties be cutting back in mm-hmm. retrospect? I'm having a problem with that.
Well, we have 36 independently elected governing bodies, but the discussions I've heard, you have counties that have to prepare. It's a matter of how do you manage a limited resource, and the assumption that some counties are going to have to go by is that this will not be reauthorized. It's got a treacherous path to take. So to be responsible stewards of their revenue, they've got to, rather than going into next year with nothing and cutting everybody to the bone and all of that, some of them are doing step downs. So and I hasten to add, if that doesn't work for the local population, then folks will be recalled or won't be reelected. But that's the decisions that they're having to make now.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, if I may.
Yes, please.
And I appreciate the fact that they may be making cuts, but those are some of the same decisions that we have to make as legislators in this building, too, particularly where you get matching grants and those kinds of things. I guess my next concern would be, other than just decimation of certain county assessment facilities, what is this going to make the overall assessment process throughout all 36 counties look like when we're done? If we go ahead and do this for the retrospective year and on the 10% match basis.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, maybe John and I should talk, because he might be more current on particular sensitive situations in counties with respect to the plans with A&T.
Yeah. I'll withdraw my question.
Maybe
Chair,
we should go.
All right. Thank you very much. Yes, Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Thank you very much for the offer to suggest that we work this out. Although, as try as I might, I can't think of how we could talk through a solution. We have a situation where the law says that if they cut their expenditures at all, mm-hmm. we will not distribute to that county. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're up against. A question for you, I think, is do you want to allow counties to cut more than what's in the bill, or don't you? I mean, do you? That's the question I think I see. I think
you've heard from some members that that's unlikely from their point of view.
The department really doesn't. That's a policy decision for you, and I don't know that we would choose one or the other.
Thank you.
So we've got a triangle here.
Let me ask a different question. If you could get this bill and no other, would that improve your situation at all?
Mr. Chair, it would provide for, I suspect, a handful of counties the opportunity for some flexibility.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, I just might add that they still would have then the opportunity to make their best case before the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee.
Correct.
And this committee will have accomplished, I think, particularly with the Dash 1 amendments, will have accomplished a handful of counties being saved harmless from the severe, most severe impacts. And I am concerned about the possibility of certain counties assessment activities going just down a drink, and I am very concerned about that, and that's a discussion also for another day and perhaps another bill and resource. So
thank you. Anyone else on the public hearing? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on House Bill 3532? Not seeing anyone, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3532, open a work session,
Mr. Chair,
on House Bill 3532.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler.
I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3532, dated 3-26-07.
Representative Butler moves the dash one amendments to the bill. Conversation, discussion? Is there objection? All right, the dash ones are amended into the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move House Bill 3532 be engrossed into that with the dash one amendment, moved to the floor with that due pass recommendation.
Representative Butler moves House Bill 3532 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Butler.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative Belzer.
Excused.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative
Witt.
Aye.
And Chair
Barnhart. Chair votes aye. I will carry the bill. Anything else? Close the work session on House Bill 3532. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3264. Thank Chair Witt of the Workforce Committee for the privilege of having a hearing on this bill. We appreciate it very much. We'll hear a summary of the bill, and then we'll call Chuck Chekatoff and John Hottinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3264 defines what a development subsidy is to include any expenditure of public funds, and that includes tax expenditures greater than $25,000 for the purposes of stimulating economic development within the state. Requires the Economic and Community Development Department to submit an annual Unified Economic Development Report to the legislature. The report is to include all types of development subsidies. The report shall include the revenue impact of tax measures as reported by the Department of Revenue within that report. Local taxing districts are required to report all property tax abatements to the Department of Revenue. Recipients of development subsidies are required to report industry classification, number of jobs, and the project average wage. Each of the public bodies granting the development subsidy must report on the progress of the recipient in meeting employment and investment targets. A recipient who fails to supply information is subject to a fine. The granting body is restricted in the subsidies that they can provide. They must have a cost per job that is less than $35,000. Health care is provided to employees, and wages meet certain targets. Requires a subsidy recipient to meet targets within 2 years of the date and maintain targets for a minimum of 5 years. If requirements are not met, the granting body is directed to recapture subsidy from recipient. Specifies the methods for doing that, and then it states the granting body who fails to follow recapture provisions when appropriate is subject to civil suit.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Chuck Chekatoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3264. I'm going to give a little context to the bill and then turn this over to John Hottinger to talk about his experience with this type of measure in the state of Minnesota. This bill essentially helps you answer some important questions. It'll help you answer the question, how much does Oregon spend through both the tax code as well as the online budget for economic development. Puts it all in one place by creating a unified development budget. It helps you answer the question, does all that money that we're spending work? Is it well spent? And are the recipients being held accountable? And having some standards for our economic development work. Are we creating family wage jobs, or are we putting money where we're actually just shifting responsibility through economic development onto a business that may be relying on public services for its employees for basic needs like food and health care? The bill, 3264, which Representative Rosenbaum brought to the committee to be introduced as a committee bill, is based on a model legislation by the organization Good Jobs First in Washington, D.C., which is a national resource center and clearinghouse on economic development. Good Jobs First took what is a very good bill law in Illinois, and that's actually what Senate Bill 518 was, so that's the connection with Senator Walker's bill. She took the Illinois law and said the legislative council draft it. I spoke with Representative Rosenbaum, and Representative Rosenbaum took the model legislation, so it has the best of Illinois and then some, because there's some other states like Minnesota, as you'll hear about in a moment, Maine, and a few others who have good disclosure and accountability provisions on economic development. So what it does is it puts in everything from tax breaks to incentive programs, use of the governor's strategic reserve fund and the like, as well as online budget items. That's not well defined in what they are necessarily in the bill, and I don't know how far you want the legislation to define it or the rules under the bill to define it. And there's gray areas you have to sort of decide. How much of higher education is economic development? Well, clearly in my mind, putting money into developing nanotechnology is probably, and research about nanotechnology is probably economic development. Probably the joint effort to have an MBA program in the Portland area by a number of the state schools together is probably economic development. How far down in higher ed it goes, or in K-12 or other programs, I don't know. But you just have to decide that and be transparent about that. In 1995, the legislature enacted the law that created the tax expenditure report. That law, if you look at the name of it, it's in the back of the tax expenditure report, was called the Budget Accountability Act of 1995. And that was being debated in the legislature. It had been debated for a number of years. People were afraid that the disclosure would hurt their program. I was with legal services at the time, and I made a proponent of it, and I had nonprofit organizations going, oh no, they're going to find out that we don't pay taxes on our property. We're going to lose the tax break. And I tried to assure them, I successfully did, that no, they're not, that a lot of tax breaks are good and important and they're going to stay in there, we're just going to know how much they are. What did that do in passing that? What it did is, did it wipe out a lot of tax breaks? No, I can actually only point to two that I think directly were in those initial tax expenditure reports that went away. One was the gift packs of cigarettes were tax-free, those packets of five cigarettes they used to hand out at Pioneer Square in the 50s and 60s. And the tax expenditure reports showed that all lottery winnings were tax exempt. And most people didn't know that. People selling lottery tickets didn't know that. People buying them didn't know that. And so the legislature changed the law and said anything over $600 you're taxed on. And despite the lottery commission's early analysis of that saying this is important to sell tickets, ticket sales did not go away once we started taxing. So those are two direct ones. I think there's been a number of bad ideas that don't get far as a result of the tax expenditure report. And I think the discussions in the revenue committees about tax breaks and incentive programs have been better because of the tax expenditure report. It taught people that there were a lot of tax expenditures that didn't have sunsets, and it taught people about the size of them, the sheer volume of the dollars that we forego due to those tax breaks. So what does this bill do? It adds accountability. It's not a bill that goes after tax breaks in any way. As Senator Starr mentioned this morning, it'll help put in writing in a state document that certain tax breaks which aren't evaluated and it's hard to get the data are better. It puts them on the same, in a public process, much like the direct online budget. That, you know, if the head of the Department of Human Services went to the Ways and Means Committee and said, give me money for my welfare to work program, but couldn't tell the committee how many people were going to get jobs, the nature of those jobs, or they were still going to need public assistance when they got those jobs, they probably wouldn't get that money for the jobs program. And what this does is it adds that. We have some transparency today on after the deals are signed, but it's not easy to get. If you want to find out about certain deals that you've read about in the paper that have been fully negotiated or in place, you have to do a public record request. You just can't go to a website. This bill incorporates the provisions of the Illinois law that you can go to a website in Illinois and look up all the deals. So last summer, what got me to write this column that led to Senator Walker introducing her bill, the state of Illinois worked a deal with Pabst Brewing. And so you'll be able to go to the Illinois website to see whether Pabst Brewing is living up to the deal that the governor in Illinois signed in the summer of 2006. I think the bill did get caught up, like a lot of bills, in the backlog at Legislative Council and needs some work. The table on page 4 should be adjusted to be consistent with our minimum wage and whatnot, and needs to be organized. I think some things should be done biennially that might be annually in here and the like. But essentially, the bill is a better bill than 518 because it is more comprehensive, and it'll only add to what you're doing. To steal the thunder of someone who testified on the other side this morning, you know, it will also help instill some help improve public confidence in what you're doing. you'll be able to show people whether how the programs that you're spending money on are working, the nature of the jobs you're getting for those programs, and that'll hopefully restore some public confidence in the role of government as very important in the economic development arena. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to John Hottinger in a brief introduction. He's a 16-year state senator from Minnesota. Minnesota is one of the states that had early accountability laws, and he can talk about that. He'll talk about the impact on the economy in Minnesota and the business community's involvement with those. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnard, Vice Chair Reed, Vice Chair Butler. My name is John Hottinger. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. As Chuck just outlined, I served in the legislature of the state senate for 16 years and chose not to run for re-election this year. I also must acknowledge Representative Rosenbaum. I have been in such a short time, and your legislature is just as busy as ours is, so I haven't had a chance to say even hello. So hello. I appreciate the work she's done in this bill, and I'm here to be supportive of it.
Well, thank you very much for coming, and we appreciate your willingness to take a busman's holiday.
Well, Mr. Chair, I wish I would have taken three or four holidays now that I've come out here. I haven't been in the western edge of Oregon before. I was taught the tell for the out-of-town person is that I say Oregon. So I will be respectful and pronounce it properly if I can. But I wish I had more time, because it's a beautiful countryside and a beautiful state. And we often think of Oregon and Minnesota and Wisconsin and a few other states of having a lot of similar attributes in terms of the educational accountability here and in terms of the beautiful climate and beautiful areas you have. So I'm happy to be here. One of the things I also learned while I was in state government, I was very actively involved in the Council of State Governments and NCSL. I served in 2004 as national chair of CSG, and in that opportunity I got to go to a number of states, and I've become a big fan of learning from each other. I've seen things that have happened in other states that we have used in Minnesota. In fact, our decisions on land use and health care have been informed by decisions that Oregon made. We have hopefully contributed to other states and their ideas, and the states are, in fact, the laboratories for good policy. We sometimes make mistakes, we sometimes do things good, and we learn from each other in what we do. So I hope what I tell you about Minnesota's law and the experience we've had in the last 10 years will be helpful and relevant to the debate you have about Representative Rosenbaum's bill and Senator Walker's bill. Let me go through history and what we've learned, and I've submitted written testimony, and the one thing I know is the last thing you want me to do is read it. I think you're perfectly capable of doing that. So let me summarize some of the things that I want to highlight. Minnesota's had a reporting law since 1995, and I can tell you these things for sure. It has had no discernible negative impact on our business. It provides now accountability for taxpayer money. It makes sure that recognizing the... I hope that's not mine. I don't think it is. No. Recognizing the limited resources we have, we make smarter decisions in terms of... Oh, I know. Tooth loss. We make decisions that are smarter in the use of our dollars. And that's very important in these always difficult budget times. But it's also changed the culture of how we do economic development in Minnesota. We are now arguing in terms of attracting business or retaining business about the strengths we have as a state. Not just the tax discussion or the incentive discussion, but our excellent education system, our good workforce, the culture of our communities, where people like to live, just as they do here in Oregon. And we also have found that we are getting more agreements and closer cooperation between municipalities, so we can look at regional development without the competition that too often is bid up the subsidies without any return to the public or any return on taxpayer dollars invested. We started out in 1995 with this reporting law, and in 1999 and 2000, we greatly expanded it to set up procedures and written agreements and prior standards that we were going to be using both at the state and municipal level. Since 2000, there has been no effort to amend our law or change our law, and frankly, on a bipartisan and bi-ideological basis, it's been broadly accepted. 1994, 1995, that wasn't the case. 1994, one of the organizations that looks at, as Chuck talked about, tax incentives, came out with a report, and from that it led to a discussion where we thought maybe it'd be a good idea to have visibility and public participation and decisions about public subsidies just as there are in other policy areas. Maybe we should have written standards, criteria, goals to make sure there's a return to the public in terms of jobs and wages and economic development, both before an agreement is reached and at the time an agreement is reached. We also thought accountability and public information and the progress towards those goals was a good thing from a policy standpoint, but also from an economic standpoint. And finally, we thought there should be some consequences to the failure. That if someone makes promises and we use public dollars to help them and they fall short of those promises, there should be some opportunity for the public to get a return of a portion of what's been invested. We put that into a bill in 1995. The bill was sent to the governor. The governor vetoed it. Now, that wasn't a really good start. And I probably amplified that by being quoted in the paper as saying that when the business community comes home at night, they empty their pockets and they find loose change, lint, and Governor Carlson. Governor Carlson has become a good friend since then. And we worked very hard over the next 6 months to work with the governor's office, to work with the business community that was a little sensitive about it at first, to work with economic development directors, and to work with a variety of people of different ideologies and parties to construct a reporting bill that makes a lot of sense. And as you looking at the details of this bill, I suggest you look at how we worked out the very issues that I know you're going to have to look at. So by 1995, same governor, the bill passed well. It got support from the governor and from his economic development commissioner. Minnesota decided we wanted to go further. So the next year, envision this, the head of the most progressive lobbying group in the state, liberal lobbying group in the state, and the head of the Chamber of Commerce together came in front of our committees and said, we want a commission to see how we could improve upon this, get even more accountability. That commission included some of the strongest free market legislators, some of the strongest people who believe government shouldn't be giving subsidies, some who supported subsidies, the chamber, liberal interest groups, business people. We went around the state, we had hearings, and unlike most commissions where the report ends up, you know, on the back shelf, it was a unanimous report that we implemented into the changes in 1999 and 2000, which set up a lot of additional protections for making wise investments and providing accountability. Since then, and since 2000, we have not had any change in that legislation. Democrats, Republicans have been supportive of it. When our new governor, who is certainly the most business-oriented governor Minnesota's ever had, came forward with his economic development proposals, there wasn't even any question. They all had to meet the standards of reporting and sunshine and accountability and consequences that we had enacted starting in 1995. So it has been broadly accepted. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, we worked closely with them. It's the largest business group, in order to make sure that we did things in a way that was both providing that sunshine and that accountability, but also being respectful of the additional work that might have to be done on behalf of people who receive public grants. What has happened since then? Well, Minnesota's economy has been strong. If you draw a line from Maine down to Texas and back up to Washington, Minnesota's economy has been the strongest economy in those states. Now, I note Oregon's on the other side of the line, so I'm not comparing us with Oregon. But we have had the strongest economy, the best job growth, the best improvement in personal income. Now, that's not because we have this law, but the point is it hasn't been hurt by the law that we've required to make sure there's more accountability. The investments we've made in terms of public subsidy, this isn't for or against, it's making sure we make good decisions, haven't hurt us. A number of business journals have indicated Minneapolis and St. Paul is the third best place to grow your business or to move your business. We're a high tax state, there's no question about it, but we're also a high services state. And I think Chuck pointed out a quote in Fortune magazine that says it works in Minnesota. High taxes, high services. And we count on our education and our other assets in order to attract business. We're also pleased with the responsiveness of local governments. Local governments, which provide a lot of subsidies in Minnesota, have to comply with our rules, which include advance notice, public hearings, votes on all subsidies, contracts that are signed and publicly available, and updates every year on the progress being made. They weren't the biggest fans. The Economic Development Association of Minnesota was the biggest opponent and was the last one to come on board. I was considered the great Satan from their point of view when I first introduced the bill. But we were open and we worked with each other, and they found out after a couple of years that, you know, this is not harming our ability to attract business. It's making us smarter in how we do that. So this is the high point. In 2001, I was named the Senator of the Year by the Economic Development Association of Minnesota. So we learned two things. Number one, you work together with people and you can come up with a good result. But number two, this bill is something that's helping Minnesota make good decisions. Thank you. I don't want to be presumptuous enough to try and tell you the details of your bill. That has to be uniquely Oregon, just like it is in Illinois or Minnesota elsewhere. But I can tell you that the concept that we've adopted in Minnesota, that you have before you and Representative Rosenbaum's committee bill, is a concept that can improve the decisions you make about providing public subsidies, provide accountability, and provide the kinds of things you'd need from any other government program in order to make sure it's working right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator, and Mr. Shekhtov for being here. I don't want to presume that Minnesota law is the same as what we see before us, but in case it is, one, I'm curious about your experience. In the measure summary, it talks about how it specifies a method of recapture and it says that the granting body who fails to follow those provisions are subject to civil suit. Did you have any of those experiences in Minnesota, and what was that like?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Reed, we have had experiences. We do have a clawback provision. And the first $1 million we took back from a company that had received some subsidy got plenty of public coverage. And the company recognized that, paid it back, didn't complain about it. So we have clawback provisions. Again, if you look at the specifics of the Minnesota law, it's different than the proposal in front of you. And as you work through things, you can evaluate that difference. But that was a fundamental part of it. We wanted to make sure if money was given to an entity based on promises of what they're going to provide in wages and jobs, and they didn't do it, and our provision allows some recognition of economic downturns and things like that, we wanted the ability to have some consequences for not doing that. In fact, one of the consequences in Minnesota, if you get a public subsidy from a local government or from state government, and you don't meet the goals and you don't meet of jobs and wages, and there is a clawback, you're also not eligible for any subsidies from our governments for the next 5 years. What that does is makes realistic the initial discussion of what goals should be. You don't come in and say we're going to create 2,000 jobs and say we created 500, didn't we do good? You come in and say we can create 500 jobs.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Thank you. Senator, thank you for coming. We appreciate it. I've never been to your fair state, but hope to someday. In the meantime, enjoy ours. When you started this, did you start with basically the reporting requirement in one piece and then move on to the sort of target standards that everyone, or did you go in one piece? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Booker, we started out with the reporting requirement. Our first goal was to make sure we had information so we could make decisions about what, if anything, was necessary in terms of the public process, in terms of what kind of requirements should be made. That reporting process led us to a lengthy discussion and also led us to the fact that maybe we needed to set some firm guidelines. And that required local governments to have hearings, to have local governments vote on any subsidy, to have the public involved, to have the clawbacks, although that was, I think, in the first bill, and also to make sure that there was a real process to make sure that we could follow up afterwards and make adjustments.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes, please.
So, did you have a period where it was just reporting, or did you go directly in one statutory provision from report? I guess I'm looking at what's before us, and it's sort of the whole piece, and it seems sort of a lot to swallow in terms of a sea change, and I'm looking at I think your goals are laudable. I like this idea. I'm looking at staging it in some way, and I come kind of trying to come at how you did it in terms of how long of a period did you have between the time when everyone was reporting the same things in the same way that you then could see the next step, which would be to have uniform provisions around public input and then on to the more punishing pieces in here. Well, if you don't meet these standards or that target, which, you know, seemed to me also would fluctuate from point to point and goal to goal and area to area, but obviously you've thought of all these things.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Berger, yeah, we did do it in a staged approach because we were the first ones, I think, who did this innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Other states have done it more rapidly because there's some experience to rely on. And we did the reporting. We had the discussion of the clawback and some other provisions early on. But then we went through a process of building because while the business community quickly really got on board because many of them looked at this as that the better way to attract business was a broader perspective in terms of state policy and also some free market concerns that why should you subsidize business A in competition with already existing business B and hurt business B? That's not a very fair economic decision. But we were the first. We were the ones out of the chute in this discussion, and so we took our time. But I know other states have done it much more rapidly because we've at least set a standard.
Thank you.
Yes,
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger. You know, the advantage of this is a Model Act, so it has the whole pie. I think, but I'm not 100% sure, that Illinois did more changes at once when they, for what 518 is, Senate Bill 518. But the advantage, if you look at our system, you assume that, yes, we have most of our, vast majority of our programs are working, and we probably have good data if we just go over to the economic development and dig through their files. But there may be a few bad apple deals out there that either local government or the state has done, and you don't change the standards and all you do is get reporting, then you're going to actually bring those to light, the bad ones to light, versus changing the standards and making sure that future deals aren't going to be bad. I mean, that's sort of one of the problems. So right now, you know, you could go through and look up all the money that's been spent through the Strategic Reserve Fund. It's public record, final decisions made. And you could see, wow, none of these have, there's a whole bunch of them that might not have any wage or health benefit standards. There might be no reporting on them. You don't know if they work. And so if all you're having is reporting, you're not helping instill public confidence, frankly, that incentive programs are good. And so, and on the other hand, just passing standards to improve the incentive programs, which you could do, and not do the reporting side, we can still get it under public records law, ultimately, if they have to do it. But if the state isn't, and this gets to Representative Reed's question, if local public officials aren't doing their deal and there's no enforcement of that, then you still have the public confidence problem that there's a waste of money going on somewhere or unfair competition between businesses or whatnot. So that's the advantage of doing the whole pie, or a good portion of it up front, so that you can move the state in the right direction, assuming that when you start looking at what's there now, you might not find everything that you like.
Mr. Chairman, could I add one?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Berger, Minnesota in 1905 at the state level already had clawback provisions as part of any of their subsidies. So it was only the transition to local government where this was a relatively new thing. In fact, when I talked about that $1 million payback, that was based on a pre-1995 clawback provision of the state. So that's been a long time policy for the larger state commitments.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Huttinger, it's really great to hear your testimony. And I have been to Minnesota and St. Paul in particular, and it is a wonderful place. And your state capital is indeed beautiful. This bill is really consistent with a lot of the things that people talk about all the time, which is accountability and, just auditing and sunshine and all of that. And it's really great to hear that it can actually work. And also, I was really delighted when Senator Walker talked about how, you know, there was support regardless of where you sit on the subject of tax incentives and tax abatements. Because I think, really, if you support these programs or if you're a critic of them, you should want this information to come to light so that people can rest assured that their tax dollars are being well spent. So I just wanted to applaud you for the great work, and thank you a lot for being here.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Senator, for your testimony. I had two questions. One, I think it's a very, very easy question. That is, when it talks about any expenditure of public funds, much of our public funds go out in these kinds of economic development programs to build infrastructure for cities. The DEQ is getting ready to shut down the city of, fill in the blank on most eastern Oregon cities, and you'll have it. And so in order to get their water up to fewer parts of nitrogen or arsenic, they've got to make some changes, or in order to protect the sewage lagoons, they've got to tell me what happens there. There's no I think I know the answer, but I need to make sure that we get it on the record.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, Minnesota's law is limited to specific subsidies to a specific industry or a specific business. This bill, in some respects, goes broader than what we tried to do. So we are more directed at the something less than an industry or less than a statewide provision. So I'm not quite sure how your system works, as you just discussed. Ours is more focused on the individual subsidies or the special industry being highlighted subsidies.
Representative Barnhart, Representative Butler, I think that's actually a very good question. That's what I was trying to get at, and at looking at the spending side, not necessarily incentive payment to a particular business or whatever, but it's the money for improving sewers or whatever. That's certain. We have to make some decisions, and you have to give some guidance in the statute, and then ultimately the department that's putting this together will have rules and guidance for how they define what spending is economic development and which isn't. And, you know, I absolutely agree. Some infrastructure work that's being done in communities is for economic development. And so that side of what's most exciting to me about this bill is that we will have now we have the budget of the governor, we have the tax expenditure report, which is the second volume of the budget, and this would be a third, which basically melds the two of those together on how much are you all spending on economic development. And you can show that, you know, when you're putting money into sewer systems and communities that need that for public health reasons or whatever, that is good for economic development. When you're putting money into bridges, that's good for economic development. And I think it'll show that a significant portion, you know, a lot of people talk about, we have this economy, then you have the government. Well, as, you know, Tom Potowski, the former state economist, used to give talks at he gave a city club, annual economic analysis, and he talked about how the dry cleaner in Pendleton doesn't have two cash registers, one for those who work at the prison and one for everyone else. Oregon is a part of the economy, and you spend significant resources in the governor's budget improving the economy. I would argue from pre-K through higher ed, a significant portion of those are economic development, to infrastructure work like you're talking about. And I think that's what's that's what's most exciting about this, is getting that unified development budget to see that Oregon, and so we can convince the voters that it's not the economy versus Oregon. Oregon is a major player. It's bringing in federal dollars, and it's spending taxpayer dollars wisely to improve the economy and the lives of Oregonians.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Butler, last 3 years have been my most delightful ones in the Minnesota legislature because I chaired the Early Childhood Committee, both the Policy and the Budget Committee. And I have been arguing there that almost every penny we spend in early childhood is economic development or public safety, certainly education, because the investment we make, the investment we make in early childhood comes back many times. And we have had economists from the Federal Reserve System and elsewhere coming that way. So, you know, wise decisions ultimately are economic development. And what we're trying to do, at least what I understand Representative Rosenbaum is trying to do, is identify that. And that's a good thing. And see the return on the investment.
Another question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to follow up on that, but perhaps this isn't the time or place. But I do have a follow-up question on another matter, and that is, some of the kinds of expenditures which we make in tax expenditures, that is money that we may not collect, to incent industries to come to Oregon, to incentivize them particularly to come to low-wage areas, high unemployment areas, those may, and hire as few as half a dozen people. those may not meet the bar, this high bar that is set out in House Bill 3264. What do? Do we penalize those folks that have moved to Oregon and have intentionally located in fossil Oregon population 32, or who have intentionally come to Adrian population 112 and have brought their businesses here so that they could hire six local people, and then we come back and say, you don't meet the high bar, we will penalize you, and you say, wait a minute, what's the penalty? We came here to hire people and to put them off of the welfare rolls and onto our payrolls. What's the penalty, other than shipping them out of Oregon?
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, under Minnesota law, there wouldn't be any penalty. If we have a program in Minnesota, as many states do, to help encourage rural development. We have some economic incentives, some subsidies that are provided to help encourage hiring low-income workers. And the way we've done it with our law is making sure the goal is to report so we know what you're doing. It's not to penalize you. It's to make sure that we have an understanding. And our governor is very pro-business and supports those programs to help low-income areas and to help population disparate areas. Included in his bill, without any problem, our full agenda of issues on economic development. So we recognize that in our bill. For instance, housing isn't covered by ours under certain definitions, or cleaning up brownfields. But all we're trying to do is get information so we can make good decisions and make good assessments. The company you talk about, Representative, I think would look pretty good in this bill. And we don't require everybody to have 300 jobs or pay $12 an hour. We discussed that because that's important. But we ended up saying local communities should set the level of what kind of wages that they're willing to give ahead of time and then drop any subsidies that meet their local standards.
Thank you.
And then report.
And then report, yes, because that's the key accountability measure.
Okay. Other questions? I'm not certain that what I have is a question as much as a comment. One of the things you said very early on in your testimony was that Minnesota is a high tax, high service state. I think I'm beginning to understand how you pull that off. You get people are willing to pay taxes when they understand that they're getting value for their dollar in terms of helping take care of the family with education support, help take care of business and industry with transportation and the other basic things that business and industry has to have, well-educated workers, and that the state spends its money wisely in order to accomplish the various goals that the legislature has agreed are important. As I say, it's not really a question, but I now understand how you got there, and we appreciate very much. Does that spark anything else? Thank you very much for visiting. Come back again soon.
I intend to. One visit is not enough. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We appreciate that.
Representative Roosevelt, thank you.
Thank you.
We also have several other witnesses who would like to be heard on this bill, and I'm going to take them more or less in order. Arthur Towers. Now, for everyone, you do recall that this bill is not in this committee. It will go back to the Workforce Committee. And so Representative Witt is here, and he's listening carefully. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on this legislation. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees Union Local 503. Now, I'll make my comments brief, although I will state again for the record that I do know what an IBM card is. So, I really want to applaud the committee for considering this legislation today and having this conversation. The challenge that we're facing here with this legislation is cynicism. And cynicism in government. And I think that people on all sides of the aisle, everyone on this committee is trying to do good things here. And the big enemy to that is the voter distrust of government, I think. And this is a good step in the right direction to enhance voter confidence in government. And, you know, frankly, I'm the enemy when it comes to some of this stuff because I am a skeptic on tax incentives for businesses. But the testimony from this morning's hearing and this afternoon's hearing, the conversations we've had, it's going to open my mind a little bit about the potential that these hold. And so the idea that we can study these a little bit more, get a little bit more information, and find ones that really work, you know, that's a powerful concept. And investing money in ones that have demonstrable impact, again, has opened my mind at least, which, for better or for worse, have been relatively closed on the front end. So, again, we're in favor of the concept. We're curious to work with you on the details, and we'll go from there. Thank you very much.
Questions for Mr. Towers? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Very much. We have Andy Shaw and... I'm going to butcher this name, Ron from the city of Gresham.
That sounded pretty good, Mr. Chair.
Well, except I didn't say the name.
Good afternoon, Chair. Committee members, Andy Shaw with the League of Cities. We're actually quite concerned about a few of the provisions of this bill. They're really practical concerns. In particular, we're concerned about the language that would prohibit local governments from providing any kind of development subsidy unless it met the specified criteria. We feel that that hobbles our ability to conduct urban renewal programs, other programs locally that are not necessarily related to creating jobs, but about revitalizing communities, about investing in communities, leveraging private investment. So we feel there's somewhat of a mismatch between the job goals in this bill being layered on top of local programs that have different goals. The reporting requirements in particular are also very broad and rather onerous. Our initial estimates, and they're rough because the requirements are pretty broad and we're trying to understand exactly what they would require, but our initial estimates are that it would cost cities in the range of $7.5 million in staff time to comply with those reporting requirements. We think this would affect urban renewal, could affect things like the historic preservation tax credits for commercial system development charges. We give credits and loans with using system development charges, which are clearly economically related, but they're not about job creation. They're not related to certain wage levels. I think Mr. Shekhatov mentioned being afraid of exposing or providing casting light on local programs. That's not our position at all. We're afraid of having some of our very important investment and financing tools hobbled. So we urge you to look carefully at those, or the workforce committee to look carefully at those provisions of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Papsdorf, representing the city of Gresham.
Papsdorf,
yeah.
Thank you. I could have gotten it.
I can stick with Ron, if you'd rather.
It's fine.
Thanks for the opportunity to be here to testify at the committee today on this bill. As drafted, the city of Gresham would oppose this bill as it's currently written, mainly because it does intrude on local authority and decision making, and because we believe it would hamper some of our important economic development efforts. We don't have a problem, as Andy said, representing all cities. We don't have a problem with some reasonable reporting requirements. In fact, the tools that we use at the local level where we are giving tax incentives as a development subsidy, we already are required and we freely do hold public hearings, and those are publicly debated at the local level before those are awarded. Most of the economic development initiatives in Oregon do happen at the local level under the supervision of our elected city councils and county commissions. Cities and counties are at the forefront of these economic development efforts. Most of the tools that we use at the local level are aimed at a variety of community goals, not necessarily just job creation. We have in Gresham a very distressed community in Rockwood, and we have, through our voters, adopted an urban renewal district aimed at revitalizing that part of our community. Job creation is not the primary purpose of that tool. It's really getting reinvestment back in that community, and we're worried that an artificial criteria of a cost per job created really does hobble those efforts when we have economic development tools that we're using that are aimed at a different goal than just job creation. Finally, I think as Andy alluded to, the definition of development subsidies in the bill is so broad that we do believe that it would eliminate our ability to use other tools that we do that aren't directly aimed at economic development, and they aren't aimed as a specific business incentive or development incentive, but do indirectly achieve the same thing. Significant capital improvements that we make in transportation. Clearly, we do a lot of transportation investments in capital to help economic development, but that's not the primary goal, and it has other benefits to the community as well. But unless we could demonstrate under this bill that there was a cost per job created measure met, we wouldn't be able to make that investment. Also, we do give systems development charge credits to certain developers, not necessarily to recruit them or incent their location in the community, but to incent other behaviors we're trying to get them to do. For instance, on the transportation side, if an employer is willing to change their shift schedules in order to reduce the amount of traffic they add to the system during the peak hours when we have the most congestion, we will give them a credit against their transportation system development charges. That would not be allowed under this bill unless we could demonstrate some compliance with a cost per job. Thank you again. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Let me just comment and then see if you have a response. It doesn't sound as though either of you object to the idea of public accountability, periodic reporting, and those kinds of things. It's the if I understand it correctly, maybe I should ask that as a question.
I don't think we are concerned at all about accountability or having public hearings or local votes before a body and having available plans and minutes and all of that. I think we'd be...
And periodic review, periodic reports by those who are involved, who are expected to meet certain criteria, reporting on those criteria and how they've been successful or unsuccessful.
I guess the key concern there is just fiscal, to the extent that it requires more staff time to do analysis that's not already done, as opposed to providing material that already exists, analyses that have been conducted as part of the decision-making process locally. That would be fine, I think, but we'd be concerned about adding staff costs locally to conduct new analysis.
Let me try it a slightly different way so that we make sure we're talking about the same thing. When decisions get made initially, when you agree on a project and you're going to put some money in or you're going to forgive some taxes or whatever it is, you have an agreement with the people who are involved. It may be a developer, it may be somebody else, are based on the assumption that certain kinds of things are going to occur. In the example you gave of a reduction of systems development subsidies, is that the employer is actually going to change the shift of their workers away from peak travel hours so that those people won't clog the roads during the peak travel hours. I think that was the point that you made. It would seem to me that it would be fairly simple to get feedback as to whether or not that actually happened, and then the extent to which it had the desired result, and that is that it actually moved some traffic to other hours away from the peak hours. And that's really what I'm asking about. Having made the initial decision that seemed to make sense, given the proposal and the agreement that you reached, does it actually make sense? Can you then go ahead and measure down the road whether what the outcome actually was, and therefore whether the decisions that you made and the agreements that you made actually were useful and paid for the subsidy or the reduction in taxes in this case.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think since that was my example, I may try to address that.
Yeah.
We certainly do have that specific credit to assistant development charges are addressed in our local ordinances. They become a matter of an administrative application because it's not a tax subsidy. Those are really a fee for a specific impact on infrastructure. So Correct. We wouldn't call those a tax. And we don't really consider those a development subsidy. I think most people would acknowledge that they aren't really, they're not development subsidies.
Whatever you call them, the fact is that we're reducing the cost to a business in return for something which you believe is useful in the community. In this case, a reduction in traffic during peak traffic hours. And the question I'm talking about is really a different question, and that is, do you measure whether or not the agreement accomplished its goals? And if you don't, how do you know whether they accomplished their goals or not? And what would be the problem with making sure that whatever measurement you have actually gets into a larger reporting system so other people can tell, too?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the clarification on your question. Yes, in fact, in our standards for those credits, we do have measurements. We do go back and check and require follow-up work to demonstrate that we've achieved the goals. I think the issue just does become how much of that and what components of those need to be reported, how much work is it, and then to compile all of those individual pieces into a big report and submit that. And I think from our perspective, at least, the City of Gresham, some of those might be pretty nominal in the grand scheme of, I think, what we're trying to get to here, mm-hmm. and may not be worth the effort to include, as opposed to some of the larger tax, direct tax subsidies and business subsidies that might be provided, property tax abatements, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It does occur to me, too, just as a comment on your testimony, that the concerns that you have are the kind of concerns that I suspect would be very useful to take into a work group and discuss and to see if other language or other criteria could be agreed upon that would alleviate some of those concerns. Does that make sense to you as an observation?
Mr. Chair, I think that does. I think if we could limit the scope or further refine how we define development subsidy so it's more narrow, I think that would help us a good deal.
See, I don't think the purpose of this bill, if I can speak for Representative Rosenbaum and the others who are interested in it, I don't believe the purpose of this bill is to limit the clever things that local government can do in order to get work done. I think the object of it is to make certain that those clever things actually pay for themselves. If I understand it, the idea correctly. I'm getting a nod from Senator Hottinger, so I'm guessing that he would agree with that. Thank you. Anything else that generates from anyone? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And we've exhausted our list of people who have signed up to testify on this bill, on House Bill 3264. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today? Seeing none, we're finished with our agenda. We've exhausted our agenda, and that being the case, we are closing the public hearing on House Bill 3264, and the committee is adjourned. Thank you.